Behavioral Health Integrations podcast strives to inspire the next generation of mental health and addiction specialists. Our aim is to continue to raise awareness and encourage collaboration in the mental health and addiction industry so that it will continue to thrive. There are numerous approaches to treating mental health and substance abuse issues. On this show, we take pleasure in showcasing the diversity of these approaches used to improve the lives of others. So without further ado, your host, Jacob Minig.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for joining me for another Behavioral Health Integration episode. Today, we have a very special guest, Margaret Swift Thompson. Margaret is a highly rated motivational speaker with over 20 years of experience as an addiction counselor at Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation. She is very passionate about her work with groups, individuals, and organizations to educate and share the tools needed to support the whole family while they navigate through the chaotic roller coaster known as addiction. Margaret is also the executive director and addiction recovery coach for families, and she's the host of the Embrace Family Recovery podcast. In this episode, we will be discussing what really motivated Margaret to get into the field of mental health and addiction. We will also get into discussions on different types of interventions one can have on an individual suffering from addiction, especially in the family environment, and what to do if a loved one is going through an addiction, and so much more. So without further ado, let's get started. Margaret, thank you so much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be with you.
So I know you are a fellow Minnesotan, correct?
Well, many people would think so because I spent a lot of time there, but I'm actually an Onion. I'm from the island of Bermuda. I transplanted to Minnesota when I was a student at Hazelden Betty Ford in 1996, but I am a Bermuda Onion through and through. That is home, will always be home.
Okay. Okay. And then you, where are you now then?
Carolina, mountains of Carolina.
May I ask, what was the reason to go to East Coast?
Sure. So it's a combination of things, Jacob. I mean, I think the reality is we came to a perfect storm in our family with both of our kids leaving the home, wanted to downsize, and then sadly lost my mom. And then my dad's not been doing great, and he's in Bermuda and has a place here in Carolina that he likes to come to. But with his health declining, he said, could you live there so I'd have someone to come and be with?
Okay.
So my husband and I took the leap and moved out here in April, and it's beautiful.
Yeah, I heard great things about North Carolina.
Well, I'm just getting to know the community and the networking of people in the field. So it's really kind of neat to start venturing out because I'm quite familiar with Minnesota and certain aspects of that, and quite familiar with Bermuda, but this is all new. So it's exciting.
What is the biggest culture shock going from Minnesota to North Carolina? I'm just curious.
It's a great question. So I'm a Bermuda Onion, Boston University, Midwest married life, back to the East Coast down south. So I would say the biggest culture shock is how similar Carolina has been to Bermuda in island time, where everything kind of goes at its own pace. I've noticed that a lot here. And obviously the accent, which I actually kind of enjoy very much. So I don't mind that. They all think I sound strange. And I think what I'm most excited about, not having Wisconsin, Minnesota winters.
Oh God. Yes.
Sorry. Sorry for all my peeps out there, but I am so eager to not be in the frigid winters of the Midwest.
Now it gets cold out there a little bit, right?
A little bit,
but not nearly. Yeah. Yep. Yep. I hear you. I'm enjoying every nice weather we have until in a few weeks or whatever we get snow, I guess.
Right. Oh,
not looking forward to it.
I won't miss that. I did my time doing the winters.
So as we all have interesting, amazing stories, I want to learn about your amazing story on how you actually got into this field in the first place. Was it an event? Was it a calling? How was it for you?
Well, like you say, I think every human has a fantastic story, right? And I think if we take the time to learn it, it's interesting. And some things are by design and some things are by the universe intervening. And I would say a bit of both for me. I've always been a helper. I always knew I wanted to help. I thought I'd go the medical route. not for me.
And nursing, medical doctor.
Nursing, PA. Not doctor. I never had the academic background to be a doctor. Okay. And so nursing, and I was like, anatomy and physiology as a freshman in college was like, okay, I'm out. Yep. Once I started cutting open cats on a big tray, I was like, okay, I can't do this. So thankfully, people placed in my life along the way led me into the helping profession on a counseling, education type platform. Mm-hmm. And about, well, the early, late 80s, early 90s, I was in university and HIV and AIDS became a very big issue. And Bermuda was also contained, a small island, big population, had its issues. And I went back to Bermuda and I started being proactive in HIV prevention and education in a culturally conservative community, which wasn't thrilled with me doing it, but it was like a challenge for me. Mm-hmm. So I kept it up. And through a series of events, as a counselor, as an educator in prevention around use of drugs and alcohol, I always said I wasn't going to work with people who were addicted, right? Never say mm-hmm. never. But I had always said that wasn't going to be my field. And in my master's program, and I'll say this because I think, unfortunately, still this is the case for those of you out there who are trying to figure out your path. And I love that you do this for people who want to try and figure out what they want to do before they start putting the investment in their education like you did and finding mm-hmm. out what's out there. I had one class on addiction in my master's degree. That was it. And what ended up happening was a relationship. Full transparency. Uh-huh. I got involved with someone who, unbeknownst to me, had a compulsion, as they put it. And it got ugly very fast. Came out and basically the relationship ended on his part. As I often say when I talk with my clients, you know, I wouldn't have ever left that relationship. That's how sick I was, but didn't know at the time. And I did a good old fashioned geographical jump that many of us do in the world of addiction or loving people with addiction. And I left Bermuda and landed in Center City, Minnesota at Hazel and Betty Ford as a student for their 13-month program. Now, I say this also, we're very good at wearing masks when we love someone with this disease. And I knew Hazelden, incredible reputation. Mm-hmm. Why not go study? Everybody who think I'm doing good. I don't have to let people know how bad I'm doing. The whole game. But as we hear in the field, in the rooms, in recovery, we do the geographicals and yet we take ourselves with us. Yep. So nothing really changes.
Amen. Yeah.
But thankfully, some big things changed when I landed in Minnesota. And that was, I was honest a little bit and was advised to go to Al-Anon and to get a therapist in order to stay in the program. And I did it.
So did a teacher tell you this or was it a requirement?
The advisor. One of my advisors. And it wasn't in a malicious way. It was just they knew that the intensity of the program, if I didn't do my own work, I wasn't going to get through it. And they were right. And they also put me on a women's unit for the first 6 months of my program, not on a men's unit, because I needed to get some stability under my belt so that I didn't have transference and other issues in my work with men.
Okay. All right.
And the rest is history. Got into the field. Love it. Wouldn't even imagine I would ever do anything different.
So do you owe a lot to that first addiction class? Because like you said before, you would not have been aware of certain signs.
I wish I'd had more. Like it really bothers me that anyone who comes out of a master's level clinical field training within the world does not have a requirement of more when it comes to substance use disorder and addiction. Yeah. Because it's everywhere. And I think it's a disservice for our clinical fields to not have more. I don't know that I would have seen it in retrospect, Jacob. I like to think I was clued in, but my denial, my love, my desire to be loved, my own stuff I brought into the relationship, his need for secrecy, as we know about this disease, if we're not willing to get honest, we keep the people we love the furthest away the most. Mm-hmm. So it was a perfect storm, I think. In retrospect, very grateful. Mm-hmm. Very grateful that he came into my life because I don't know that I would have been given all I've been given through my own recovery had I not had that relationship.
or a lot of scenarios I see from clients is that from their loved ones, they see the red flags, but they pretend not to see them. They see them, but they turn the other way, or they accept the most basic excuses from their loved one. Oh, no, it's this or that, whatever. Oh, okay. Because again, you don't want to look at that darkness. You don't want to look at that evil, in a sense.
So I believe the need to give one another grace when we have the disease and love people with the disease is really important. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a combination of a few things. We love someone, any human being, we see the best in them. Yeah. We don't want to see the ugly bits. When we see those bits, some of us go straight for it, like I did, and ask direct questions. Others don't say anything, don't want to see it, turn away, can't cope. Some people, there's a dependency on that person for financial security, so I can't rock the boat. Yep. There's whatever I've brought into the relationship as a loved one on my own issues that I have never dealt with that come into play. I can't tell you how many people I've worked with over the decades who come from family histories of addiction, mm-hmm. and then end up with a partner who's addicted. But because they never got help with their upbringing and what they were taught by the disease, they go into this relationship and they're the perfect partner to an active yes. addict or alcoholic because they've been conditioned by the disease to be that right. and never got help for that. So there's a lot of things at play, I think, in relationships.
Or especially in relationships, that mask is so powerful, and not just your mask, but the mask as a couple mm-hmm. where you could have two very, very highly educated people, and they're a couple, in the outside world will look at them like, oh, they're great, they can hold on a job, they make good money, they got the perfect family and everything. Like, that's one of the strongest masks out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also let's add the mask of society's comfort with abuse and excess and mm-hmm. not wanting to see it as problematic. Let's look at the mask of high functioning, as you put it. The problem with high functioning is most people who have this disease and are high functioning will eventually have the wheels come off and some catastrophe will happen yeah. or consequence where either they'll make a change mm-hmm. or God forbid lose their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's why I like to talk to my clients about in groups. It's just like, all right, so in society, we call them functioning acts. What does that really mean? Right. Oh, they're struggling, but again, they could still do the basic life necessities of, oh, I could put a roof over your head, food on the table, clothes, pay the bills, and like that's good enough for now.
And the other piece that's so sad about that is that internal self-loathing that runs along with it.
Yeah.
It's one thing to look to the world like we're okay,
mm-hmm.
but to look in the mirror after you've just done some horribly non your personality behavior to the children in your life or your partner or your parent, and then to go back to your mirror and look in and realize what you did. Mm-hmm. The only coping mechanism one has in active addiction at that point is to use more,
mm-hmm.
which spirals us worse and the loathing exactly. gets worse. Mm-hmm. So even if we're looking to the world like we got it going on, it's usually behind the scenes, a pretty sad and lonely and self-loathing place we find yeah. ourselves.
Yeah. And again, getting back to the society's viewpoint on stuff too, I always love using an example of let's get into the more behaviors, right? Mm-hmm. Where you have two people, one's rich, one's not rich, and they both, let's say, have a gambling addiction. Well, the rich guy is fine. We're not even going to say he has an addiction because he can afford his behavior or whatnot, because it's not affecting his daily life in certain ways, where the average guy is going to affect his ability to pay the bills, put food on the table. But yet we're not looking at their life back at home. Okay, yeah, they can afford all these things because they're rich. Doesn't mean they don't have problems. Does not mean that. No. Maybe they're spending too much time at the casino and not interacting with their children or their wife and so forth.
Yeah. I've had the privilege of working with people from all wealth, means, mm-hmm. backgrounds. And this is the great equalizer. This disease will take people out no matter the background. Mm-hmm. And sadly, people with a lot of means can end up getting help when they're way more sick because no one around them feels they can be the one to say something's wrong here because there's mm-hmm. power or authority, wealth.
Yes.
And so it makes it really hard if it's a high executive or someone high in society who everyone's on their staff
mm-hmm.
to be the people to say something. And it's actually quite tragic. I mean, all of it is. If we look at what this destruction of the disease does to everybody, it's mm-hmm. very tragic. The good news is, unlike other illnesses, there is hope and there is a solution. The challenge is, when is the person going to be willing to embrace the solution?
I'm very curious to hear, like, what's your therapeutic like style when working with clients like that and they have a loved one who's going through these issues? Do you tell them to take a certain approach when expressing their concerns to their loved ones? How do you propose like an individual handle that? I'm just curious.
So I try really hard not to tell my clients what to do ever. No. I think that the challenge is there, right? Because we can see sometimes things clearer because we've got distance.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is, as I say to all my clients, lest I walk in your shoes, I have no business determining what's right or wrong for you. What I'm here to do is come alongside you and co-create with you a plan forward, whatever that is for you. So you want to set boundaries. Let's figure out which ones. Let's mm-hmm. strategize. Let's role play. Let's practice. And then you go set them. You want to have a safety plan because of behaviors that are outrageous in the home and you're scared. Okay, what's that look like? Let's create what that looks like for you and the kids, you know? When it's someone in a place where their loved one is getting more and more out of control, I'm a believer in being direct and honest in my approach with my clients, but also for clients to do the same. The biggest challenge for many family members is walking on eggshells. They fear if they say or do the right or wrong thing, then they're going to have whatever outcome they're supposed to have. But if they do it wrong, it's going to go really bad. And my hope is that with working with me, they recognize they don't have that much power or authority over any other human being. And that even if the addict is in their face screaming at them that they made them do it, that's a lie.
Mm-hmm. That's
the lie. It's a lie the disease tells them and us. So my hope is to come at it with love and compassion, grace for oneself, but also be direct in communicating what I see. So some of my technique is, you know, describe it as if you've seen it in a black and white movie with no emotions, just the mm-hmm. facts, Jack. Like, lay out the facts. It's hard to argue with facts. And also use I feel statements.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
As much as you can. So those are two of the techniques I use with families.
Yeah. And again, I'm just beginning my crisis career too, because I do a little part-time on the weekends. And I can just think right off the bat, when you're in those crisis situations, yes, you have to plan for A, B, and C, but safety is number one concern no matter what. Mm-hmm.
Correct. I also think part of the teaching and you know, because I think all clinical work with family is a combination of psychoeducation and understanding, as well as supporting them and figuring out their plan. You know, families, one of my biggest pet peeves is we call this the family disease. Addiction mm-hmm. is a family disease, but the services we give family are next to nothing compared to the person with the disease. If we're going to call it a family disease, we've got to offer family recovery resources, really strong ones.
Mm-hmm.
And so for part of it is understanding the tsunami that their life has become, and that they're tolerating things they would not tolerate in any other relationship in their life because they've become almost numb to it. It's progressed over time.
Yeah.
And how do we start looking at what is healthy and okay for us and what is not, and what boundaries to set around the disease while still loving the person, which is challenging for many people to learn how to do, because boundaries feel so black and white when they're not.
You know, it's funny when you said numb, it's almost like somebody's admitting, okay, my life is bad or the situation's bad, but it's not the worst thing in the world, so I'm just going to hang on to it. And it brings me to this analogy that obviously I went to Adler and I watched this Adlerian video with one therapist was talking about. And it really stuck with me because I like analogies and stuff. So he's like, you know, mental health therapy is kind of like a house, right? Now hear me out. house is like your mental health and your brain, right? So let's say your house has a few little mini leaks and there's a couple drips here and there. Oh yeah, it sucks, but it's not really that bad where you got to get help. But then the holes get bigger and bigger and then pipes start breaking. And then it's like, oh crap. Okay. I can't have this anymore. I need to fix this. And then that's that person going to therapy and getting help. You know, we can tolerate so much, but hopefully at some point there is a limit.
And my interpretation of that with clients I've worked with is just as the addict, and I call addict, and just so your audience understands this, mm-hmm. I know substance use disorder. I know all the terms. I call addict because I believe in incorporating chemical mm-hmm. and behavioral and process addictions.
Yes.
So that's why I say it that way. All encompassing. Plus, as a family member, I think the family member's drug of no choice is a walking, talking human being that they do everything around them that that person does around their substance. It is so parallel. It's yes. uncanny.
Yes.
So one of the pieces of the process for many family members is also getting to a wall or a bottom where they just can't keep it up, just like the addict speaks to, right? Where does that line where they're like, I've crossed too many, I'll never do this lines, or I've got yeah. a consequence that's too great, or I am at my bottom and I just want help. I think family members also don't change until they feel similarly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, there's that term where it's just like, do you need to hit rock bottom to actually finally change? And what is your rock bottom? Because we don't always all have the same rock bottoms.
No, and as we know, all we have to do is keep digging to find the next one. You know, I mean, yeah. the person has to be willing to say, today, I want something different, and I'm willing to lean into a program or resource, whatever path they take, and lean in as hard into that as I would into my using history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard work.
It's funny. I really love the fact that when you're bringing up like family disease, you got treated as a family. And again, I was a tech at a treatment center a while ago, so I got like a good perception of it. And one of my biggest pet peeves in adolescent treatment centers is, again, like, one, they don't have the staff that are educated properly to, again, help in a family systems type of model, because I fully agree with you. You got to bring the family in. And if we're going to use the example of the adolescent girl or boy, I feel like in the adolescent treatment centers, you know, we'll try to teach them skills, do this and that, but they're still going back to that environment with the mom and the dad using drugs, cooking a meth lab in the basement. True story, by the way. And it's just like, what work are they really doing? And again, that is one of my biggest pet peeves in the adolescent treatment center.
I think that's a challenge for every treatment center.
Sure. Yep.
What happens many times is family members, unless they are educated and given the chance to understand the impact on everyone of the disease, they believe that I'm doing due diligence by getting my person to treatment and I'm not needing help. I just need them to be okay.
Fix them.
And it's not even fix them like they're the bad or the problem. It's, I don't understand that I have been greatly impacted by this disease also. I'm in not denial, because I don't think they even realize until they start learning about the impact on them. Many family members believe that once I get them well, everything's going to be great. I believed that. Mm-hmm. I believed that if I could get him well, I was going to be great. I had no idea of the collateral damage that had been done to me
mm-hmm.
by the disease within our relationship. None.
Right.
Until I got the help I needed.
And that's what I challenge a lot of these places. It's like, okay, so you do a great job, let's say with a child or whatever, you teach them all the great skills in the world and everything, but you try to work with the family with the child and there's a lot of toxicity. There's a lot of resistance with the parents and the child. What good does it do if you're sending them back in that environment?
So what's the solution, Jacob?
That's a great question. Oh boy. I wish CPS would get involved more. And I know I'm going on a tangent right now, but I worked as an arms worker, and I've seen horrendous things in houses mm-hmm. and I would talk to CPS and this and that, like, well, we can't do anything. You know, there needs to be a foot and a half of trash around the whole apartment, and it needs to be difficult to get to the bathroom for us to even get involved in the first place. And I'm like, my freaking God. Okay, well, if it needs to be that bad for CPS to maybe get involved, then I don't know. You're right. And I'm glad you asked me that, because that's one of my original passions in this podcast, is not just to bitch and complain about issues, but you need to try to get a solution. If you're going to bitch and complain, that's great, but then you got to give me at least one solution. And I think sometimes I've been slipping a little bit on that. So I'm thankful that you asked me that question.
So the solution you see is getting more services to the family.
To my perfect world, I would want family to actually do the treatment with the child. And I wish there'd be like these maybe housing units, whatever. And each family member would go to like therapy. I mean, the kids would still go to school and everything, but after the end of the day, the family reunites again. And maybe talks about their day and build healthy structures, boundaries throughout time until, again, they're ready. So, yeah, I wish the whole family would get involved more often than a one-month visit from the adolescent treatment center, et cetera, like that.
So create it.
Right, right.
I mean, I think your idea is a very valid one. I think that the family system deserves help all the way around. And can there be a reality of something where people tap out and get chances to immerse themselves as family in a system, that in a situation that's healthy?
Yeah.
The challenges are, who's making the money, who's paying for it, who's going to continue to do what has to be done in the home? Yes. How many people can afford to tap out of their place and live somewhere else, right? Like, there's challenges all the way around. Mm-hmm. But I think a great start would be offering more to the family than a family program or a counseling session here or there during treatment. Right.
Absolutely.
Family program, most places, is a day, maybe two, maybe three, if you're lucky.
Mm-hmm.
It's not enough.
No, it really isn't. And funding, you know, there's been so many scenarios too at a treatment center where a client cannot stay for more than 30 days because, again, they are the breadwinner in their family. They do 30, but not 60 or 90, because, again, who's going to pay the bills?
Right.
You know,
I had an interesting conversation with a mental health practitioner recently that I thought was really interesting. And she was saying that she wished our education, like for families that have saved for college 529s or whatever, where they mm-hmm. help their kids go to college because they save money through the government to pay for college. When you have a child, adult child, teen child, someone at college age whose mental health is suffering or chemical dependency is out of control, why can't that resource be used to pay for care so they can possibly get to college? Because otherwise they're never going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a very interesting concept. Now, not everyone does that, but for those who do, there's a resource that could be tapped into that could potentially help this young person become a member of society that thrives.
Yes, absolutely.
It was an interesting thought because I'd never thought about it. And I was like, wow, what a concept. Like, those are resources you've saved for college, but if the person doesn't get help, they may not get to or through college.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't those resources be allocated to good treatment, mental health care, chemical health care?
Yeah. And it kind of brings me into like previous episodes I've done is it, how do we get more funding?
Mm-hmm.
I feel like, cause that's the core to a lot of these issues, is funding for programming, funding for professionals and therapists to actually work and get paid more than, like, you know, I don't want to say minimum wage, but again, I feel like all mental health professionals are extremely underpaid in our field.
So it's kind of like teachers. It's kind of like some of the other resources that are so valuable to our society. Yes. I think the other.
Are they though? Like, what are they? What is our world? Again, the question is, yes, they are. But again, what is our country and the world saying?
Right. What doesn't match?
Right.
What I was going to go to there is, I lost my train of thought, but it was something around the idea of the teachers and the counselors, mental health practitioners, and their value.
And not getting paid what they're worth.
Yeah, it was before that. Anyway, it doesn't matter. We'll come back. You edit, right, when these things happen?
Yes.
I think that the thing is, are recognizing our value, and most of us get in the field for passion. We don't get into it to make $1 million. I know for me, I say this all the time to families, and it's actually on my website. You know, if love were enough to heal these issues, I'd be gladly out of a job.
Yep.
I see love week after week after week from all relationships. Mm-hmm. And it's not something that can change the trajectory of this illness. It can change how we take care of ourselves and how we show up for our loved ones with some support and help. But it takes way more than love to get someone healthy.
Absolutely. It's a great start. It's a great.
Oh, huge.
You know, and it's really sad because you think of all like the great, amazing therapists in our country that we have lost because of this issue of student loan money or and debt and lack of pay. I mean, some states, well, I know in Minnesota, you need at least 2 years post-supervision to be licensed and then make somewhat adequate money. And it's just, it's an extremely hard path, as you know, since, you know, your certifications, your graduate degree and so forth.
I'm hoping some of the payouts of the opioid money
okay.
will be used to help some of the things change that we're talking about, whether it be funding for other programs, for more access to programs, for training, so we have more professionals, because it's a very swamped business. Most people have waiting lists because there's so much need, you know? So I'm hoping that will, some of that money will come down. I just had an interview with Amy C. Sullivan, who works at McAllister as a professor and wrote the book Opioid Reckoning, which is fascinating to read. And, you know, she was saying the same thing. I hope that those funds are allocated to a variety of different approaches and resources, because we've got to start thinking outside the box on some of the care we're giving, because we're losing too many people.
Yep, we are. We absolutely are. And it's like, who's in charge of, again, using those funds, placing them? Is it the politicians?
And we're going to do a really nice job of not going down that rabbit hole.
But do we have a choice?
Yeah, we have a choice. It's like our choice around serenity versus, you know, a very wise person said to me early on in my own journey of recovery, I am not as qualified or competent to be angry. And it's in the big book. I have to work on what my emotions are and where my energy is going and how much is it going towards things that are beyond my control versus what's in my scope to change. And if I'm going to stay healthy in the field, I better buckle up and do that, or I'm not going to make it, because the big issues can be overwhelming.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, especially in, those are great schools for graduate students to practice themselves right now.
You know? Anyone, I mean, anyone on front lines through COVID, anyone dealing with the well-being of people physically, emotionally, academically, challenges through colleges and trying to navigate COVID. It was a hell of a ride for a lot of people in the industries, frontline workers and, you know, food industries and restaurants and performers. It hit everybody. So if we can't find ways to, I believe, use the 12-step principles, which are a fabulous way to live, we're not going to do well, because the big picture is going to consume us and we're going to lose faith and hope.
Well, and I want to piggyback off of that too, because I was going to ask you, what are some of the main differences between, let's say, North Carolina and Minnesota? Because, again, you've been in the field a lot longer than I have, but I've, like, when I started working as a tech, you know, the treatment center I started working at was very pro 12 steps. And obviously I've learned other therapeutic modalities and stuff, but I still think there's that extreme conflict right now between the old school addiction counselors, 12 steps, versus like the mental health professionals and how we collaborate, work together. It is awful still. It is awful how we treat each other. And like, my way is the highway, my way is the best. And I feel like if we continue to have that conflict between us as professionals, nothing good will happen.
That conflict's been going on a long time. It went back, you know, back to basics. Let's look at when AA started and NA came to be, right?
Bill W.
Conflict there, right. So I would say the greatest gift that has been afforded me in my clinical work has been surrounding myself with a variety of people mm-hmm. who teach me, mentor me, challenge me, and being open to learning new ways, new resources, new techniques, while still holding true to what saved my hiney.
Ego. And I think the ego in oneself is the biggest destruction.
Keeps us small.
That's good. I like that.
Keeps us small. Keeps us under the thumb. And it's not what I believe my higher power intends me to be.
Yeah. It's funny because like when I think of like coordination of care too, legally, like you don't need to tell the other professional, right? Like every bit of piece of information, right? You tell them what they think they need to hear. Through my career, my experience, that's when conflicts start. It hasn't happened a lot, but I'm talking about working as an LADC in Minnesota. Oh my God. I don't know if you've ever worked with probation officers like before. And sure. Oh God, this one, again, I don't even remember her name, but she would impose her boundaries. She would email me too much. And she's like, you know, we need to start doing this with this client. We need to start doing EMDR with them. It's like, you're a probation officer. Like, this is not your scope of practice, this or that, whatever. And it was a huge blow up, you know, and it was, she sent me the thing that really made me explode. Like, she literally sent me an email saying, you don't give me enough information. Every person I work with gives me a lot more than you do, this and that. And then that was like my breaking point. And I just let her have it. Was it professional? Yeah. You know what? I think it was respectfully as professional as I can make it. And I was just respectfully telling her, I told her, I explained the amount of information that I thought it was appropriate for you to know regarding the client and their therapeutic goals and your scope of practice. And maybe I should not have brought her scope of practice involved in it, but that's pretty much the gist of it. You know, I told you what I felt like you needed to hear in regards to the client. Mm-hmm. And I'll just stop there. And
I don't know. I remember working with probation officers, and I would have great supervision where people would say to me, take a step back, because I would get reactive, yep, and walk a day in their job. And could you do it? There's no way I could do it. Can you have compassion for that truth? And can you also keep your concern as your priority for your client, but also be honest and upfront about whatever aspects need to go forward with them? I think that a good friend of mine in the field would say to clients and families all the time, mainly families, our job as individuals is to keep an eye on our own bobber, right? Yep. Stop watching everyone else's bobber and whether it's going up and down, because if you're fishing, you're never going to catch anything. And I have to do that to stay sane in my clinical work.
Yeah.
What is mine? What is my requirement? What is my responsibility? And I'm working as a coach now, which is a very different approach in some ways. It's very much here and now, solution-based, working in conjunction with therapists if they need other care, you know? Mm-hmm. But it's really, I have a lot of respect for every person out there working hard at their job, though I may not always like their approach.
Yeah.
And I have a lot of compassion for other professionals in other fields and our field, because I think a lot of us get into it with unresolved issues of our own that show up often in different aspects of our work. Yep. What I do feel is imperative for anyone working in the field with people with this disease is to have their own recovery. Mm-hmm. I can't mandate it, but if I'm not willing to role model my own in working with other people and have compassion for the fact that they may not be, and that's not my business, but my business is to keep my side street clean, even in my work relationships,
yep,
I do better for my clients that way, because I'm keeping my eye on my own bobber. Because my crazy brain will have me out there taking the inventory of everyone around me and getting all worked up. I can't afford to do that and be there for my clients.
Yeah. When you say recovery, like, what do you mean by that in your sense of the definition?
So I am always will be, because of what it gave me, 12-step based.
Okay.
And so my recovery, I work a program around a food addiction, which came on board. I had it pre my own relationship into Al-Anon and 12-step recovery of Al-Anon, but I work both programs and my meetings are vital to me. Going back to the basics, rereading the literature, keeping it consistent, that keeps me healthy. And that's what I do for my well-being. Obviously, if I need therapy or help for other aspects that come about, or if I'm dealing with issues that I need more help, I'll get it. But my consistency through my whole career since I landed at Hazel Betty Ford was, you need to take care of you or you're not going to be there for any of your clients.
So for like a professional who's not recovery, they could look at recovery in the sense of like their personal self-care.
Well, they could look at self-care if they're working with people who are diagnosed substance use disorder or other addictions, Al-Anon. That is a meeting spot for anyone who's been impacted by this disease. And any one of us who works with clients with this disease, what a great place to go for help for ourselves.
I didn't know. I thought it was just for family members.
Anyone who's been affected by the disease, friends or family.
I know that.
Yeah. No, I think it's good to hear you say that because I think that's probably a belief of other people. Yep. But working in the field, we lose people to this disease. We have people come in and out of treatment. We come in and out of our office who do recovery or don't or struggle and then find their path. But if we're not careful, we get enmeshed or we don't have our boundaries firm. And so to me, it makes sense to do anything to care for ourselves to keep us as healthy as possible so we don't get into those positions.
Yeah, I remember I had an internship supervisor tell me too that one thing you really need to work on is just not just your professional development, but your personal development. Because again, your personal development or lack thereof is going to affect your work life. You're going to get stressed out. You're going to hold grudges, etc. I mean, yeah.
Well, and who hasn't had their ex person come into their office and show up sitting there? Like my first male client as a student was physically the spitting image of him and had similar issues.
Really?
Sure. Okay. And if I hadn't been talked, coached, supported in getting into Al-Anon, that was the first step, then therapy, what could have happened if I was not dealing with my own stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
The universe puts in our path messengers from our higher power. That's a belief I hold. And so some are messengers that give us great, wonderful things that are instantaneously lovely. And others give us really good growing opportunities that suck, but in the long run are worth every minute of it.
So I want to switch directions. What do you think of the therapeutic approach, the classic intervention? I've never asked anyone this before. You know, when the individual walks into the house and their loved ones and family members are in a circle, and that's when it starts. Like, do you think that's an outdated approach, or could there be some positive?
So what I can speak to is having worked with many people who've been on the receiving end of that.
Okay.
And also families who've done them. So what I've observed is some clients who end up in treatment as a result of an intervention spend the entire treatment process pissed off and don't get the benefit of treatment. I've also seen people coming in right off the gate, so incredibly grateful and emotional that their family did it because they didn't know how to ask for help. And had they not done it, they would have not get there. So I've had every extreme in that. I prefer interventions where the family is given more support than writing the letter and then it's done.
Okay.
That's number one. Number two, Care Frontations is an organization on the West Coast, and they work very much with helping the family prepare for the intervention in a loving, respectful, and compassionate way towards their loved one, but also holding boundaries against the disease. I believe life offers everyone interventions of different kinds, whether it be the DUI, whether it be the child looking at you. One of my interventions was my child terrified of me in one of my rages. And I remember the look in her eye. It didn't stop me, but it was one of those seeds planted that led me towards surrendering. whether it be the partner leaving, whether it be a financial consequence, right? There's all these interventions. So I do think that at times the theory of bringing the bottom up through an intervention can be very effective, right? Mm-hmm. But it can also not work. And I think that there's a place for every approach. And I don't know the answer because I'm not an interventionist of what I prefer to be the way. In an ideal world, I'd love everyone to just come to their truth and get the help that they deserve. Yeah. Not going to happen. So if an intervention is the way the family chooses to go, what I will absolutely educate clients to is two things. For the person who's received the intervention, who finds it painful, try and step back and imagine the terror and pain of the loved ones doing the process. Because it's horrifying for them. Secondly, when the person who seeks treatment and does accept help, I think it's important for family members to realize that when they go into treatment, family goes through withdrawal.
Yes.
What I think that looks like is their purview of control is gone. They want them to go. They want them to get help, but they're terrified of, will we still love each other after? Will this be good after? Will they stay sober after? Which is a lot of what the clients are saying on the other side. Will they still love me sober? Will we be able to get along sober? And
it changes roles. It changes the system roles. Like, what's going to happen now that he's different? How's he going to, it's going to rock the boat a little bit, maybe.
Homeostasis is no longer homeostasis. And what happens too for family members, my belief, when we're obsessed and preoccupied with our person, who's our drug of no choice, and then they're somewhere separate where we have no say in what's happening for them, we can't be preoccupied and obsessed with them. We start feeling our own feelings for the first time many times, and we don't know what to do with them. So we want to shove them down and go find them and take care of them, fix, manage, control them, because that's our MO. Mm-hmm. If clinicians don't understand that, all they get is the constant calls. How are they doing? Are they doing enough? Are they going to meetings? Should I find meetings for them? How many meetings should they go to? Like this constant barrage of calls. And as a clinician, I understand the bandwidth it takes to work with our clients who are critical and clinically need everything we can give them. The family needs us too. And so how do we find that balance?
What do you think of this approach? Like, would you just tell the parent, like, how are you doing right now? You seem a little tense right now, to get them to maybe look at themselves right now in that moment and what's going on.
Yes, I think that's an approach to take. The other approach is when they're asking me how many meetings their loved one needs to go to, I'll ask them, how many are you going to?
Oh.
They don't always like me, but they understand that I will bring the focus back to them.
Well, yeah, I can imagine them, like, not all, but probably some getting angry, but like a period of anger, then they sit in that and they process that, those emotions, right, that are coming out.
And I understand that to them, what feels normal, for lack of a better word, in the insanity of the fear that's killing them is to find a way to make this better.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to turn that switch off.
Yeah, it's almost, in a sense, conflict, right? Where I think it takes some courage for the therapist to do that approach, because it's almost, you have to embrace them not handling the redirection. Or maybe is redirection even the word? There's something else to it, but it's just like you need to put that approach out there to tell them to look at their own issues and be ready for them to embrace that anger that they have.
I think it's similar to when we have a client sitting in our office who gets triggered and gets pissed off because their disease gets triggered, and we meet their disease face to face and get a little sample of what's been living at home.
Mm-hmm.
This is the same for family. There are times where we're dealing with what I call their monkey, the monkey chatter that a family member lives with 24/7. And that's not usually a cute sight. And it's a survival technique that has gotten them through this. And that's important to validate and understand. And also, is it serving them? And what do we want to do different?
Right. I like that you're facing the disease in the moment. You're facing the monster. You're facing it right now. That's beautiful.
Well, think about it, right? You've sat in a room with someone or groups and you've seen, as I call it, slick, because Saul Selby was one of my mentors. You see slick show up.
Yep.
It's like, welcome to the party. Here's the disease. Now let's learn how this disease manipulates you, because then we can help you learn how to set boundaries against it yourself.
Because if you don't, you're not helping them.
Right.
You're going along with it.
Yeah. Separating the disease from the person as an addict, that's number one, and that's very hard. Separating the disease from the person as a family member when you love them is equally hard, but mm-hmm. very important.
Yeah.
And what's yeah. really cool is when families get this, I will yeah. hear children say, Slick's here, not my dad. Slick's here, not my mom. I'm not going to do this right now. And I'm like, wow, right? Like they can get that concept.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a disservice we do with kids and teenagers. We don't give them enough credit to be able to understand these teachings if we give them these teachings. And we assume that they can't understand it or it's too scary, when really what their experience is in living in it is scary enough. And they're processing it on their own, trying to figure it out and make sense of it. And the number one answer they come up with is somehow their fault.
Mm-hmm.
Is that better, or is it better to actually educate them and arm them with an understanding of what they're living with?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think more importantly, you need to give them a voice, because maybe many of them grew up without not having that voice. It's like, you screwed up, you're punished, you don't get the right to say anything back to me, authority figure, parent. They need a voice, I feel. Because mm-hmm. their whole lives, they'd never had a voice before. Now we're telling them, what are you feeling? What are your emotions? What's going on with you? And they don't know. A lot of them don't know how to handle that right away.
And sometimes their voice is the loudest voice in the family. I was in a training the other day and someone said, when you look at the different family roles in the family, you know, the hero and yes. the scapegoat and the lost child and the, you know, the hero is very much the face of, let me show the world we're okay. Don't look behind me, yes. but we're okay. And then the lost one who's just out. Any way they can get out, they're out. And they're quiet, no trouble, no ruffles. And then the mascot who's always trying to, you know. But like certain roles hold the truth of the family more. Like if you get them talking, they'll tell you the truth of the family system.
But sometimes that family member may not want them talking. But that's what therapy is. That's what treatment is. And they come back, they're changing that system. There's that threat that system is going to be changed. And then what now?
And the uncertainty of that, right? Is getting help to navigate that, even though it may change and feel uncomfortable, because change is uncomfortable. In the long run, mm-hmm. the change is for the best. It's the familiar we know versus the unfamiliar we're not sure how it's going to be.
Scary. Yeah. And
it takes a lot of courage to get help, period.
Absolutely. And I remember I had an interview with a doctor. And you know how like bipolar or schizophrenia is so overly diagnosed, where there's a lot of cases where, again, kids have been sexually abused, this or that, and they've gone through a lot of emotional issues. They get traumatized, so they get put on a lot of meds, like medications. Well, what I learned is that some of the parents or siblings may benefit from that because, again, it's holding true to this narrative, like she has issues, this or that, we get to maintain our family roles. But if you get that, let's say a little girl or boy talking, well, they're unveiling the truth, like you said, where, oh, maybe she might not have schizophrenia. She may not have bipolar. Maybe she was extremely traumatized as a kid. Mm-hmm. But again, there's that family system narrative right there that is could be changed with that voice.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I think the other thing is, as a clinician, getting into the field, whether you're going to do counseling, coaching, any kind of work with humans, to keep ourselves aware of what we're asking of our clients mm-hmm. and whether we are willing to do the same. You know what I mean? Like, yep. it's hard work. Change is hard work. It's worth it. I would not go back and not do it. But boy, when I was in it, did I want to? Hell no.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But am I willing to have compassion when families feel like they're on a treadmill and they can't get traction yeah. or when they hit that same wall and they don't do different? Am I willing to stay alongside them and recognize this is hard yes. stuff? The fact that they keep showing up and are willing to keep yep. at it is the victory. Just yes. like the addict, right? We get so incensed when there's a relapse.
Mm-hmm.
You hear it all the time, the judgment and the incensed feelings of people around them. Are they stepping back into program? Are they going back in for help? That's the victory.
Yeah. It's like you want perfection where there's a lot of treatment centers where they get kicked out right away after relapsing the first time. So what are we saying to them? Like, we just demand perfection. Well, this isn't a perfection-like field or the stuff we're dealing with.
You know? The challenge in the treatment center, and I'm sure you experienced this, and mm-hmm. I had this conversation with Amy also, was when we had someone bring substances in and use, we're not worried about just their well-being. We've got to worry about everyone else who's very vulnerable also.
Yeah.
So how do you find that balance with keeping the community safe?
Yeah.
And managing it? Because addict behavior, and I am an addict, addict behavior shows up that fast and is very triggering to each person in the room. And it can challenge the safety of a community if people are afraid to narc.
Yes.
People are afraid to call it out. People are afraid to say they're scared or they're tempted.
Yep.
And so we have to be mindful of the entire population, not just the person.
It's funny. So my LPCC supervisor, she's a licensed social worker, and she spent a lot of time just doing like one-on-one mental health therapy stuff. So sometimes it's hard for her to like relate to the life of a treatment center. And I'll be telling her, you know, this client used this at this time, at this place around the house. And she's like, honestly, if I had a client who used, I wouldn't even care. Well, then I use that same example you just gave. Well, I need to worry about if he's going to bring it in and give it to others as well. And she's like, oh, like a light bulb went off in her head. Like, I never thought about it that way. It's like, yeah, you're not just thinking about him or her. You're thinking of everyone. Mm-hmm. Now, in a classic one-on-one.
Right.
It's different.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. And the other piece is the old school thinking. If someone's using, it's the same with sponsorship. If they're using before they call their sponsor, need another sponsor. If they're using rather than engaging in recovery, what do they need to do to change? And it's tough. It's tough. But, you know, the fundamental core reality for all of us in the field, we are no one's higher power.
Amen.
We aren't. And all we can do is show up as healthy as possible, give the resources we can give, and get the privilege, which I truly think it is, to witness miracles as people engage in their well-being.
Yeah.
Watching that is amazing.
Yeah, it's really cool because like every counselor I talk to has their certain joyous moment or feeling. Like, what is your personally like your best part of the job? Is it when a client learns something, or they just you just see them experience a certain emotion in the moment?
How? That's a question. That's a big question. So I love speaking and I love coaching and in my past counseling. I love it all. I would say in my speaking environments, to see those ahas when you manage to do a role play or some sort of technique that it just drops for someone is amazing. I would say my awe in working with individuals and families is the spirit of resilience within human beings. The ability to show up and navigate life on life's terms, as difficult as it is, but keep showing up and doing it.
Yes.
And then when you watch someone put a new technique into practice and get the reward, and their joy in themselves for that moment, even if the next moment's tough, to try and have them hang on to that, to recognize the change they made. Humans are amazing. Complex, challenging, inspiring. Humans are amazing.
Well, hell, I learned so much from my clients in general. It's a really beautiful process.
It is.
You know,
we get the front row seat to growth in other humans, and that's pretty cool.
I like that. I like that term, front row seat.
Mm-hmm. Not everyone gets that gift. It's amazing. It's a privilege that I think we shouldn't take for granted, and work real hard to stay healthy for those people that we get that chance with.
Absolutely. Now I want to get into, as we wind down, you have a podcast.
I do.
What motivated you to start that? And would you like to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. What motivated me was it's a service project. I obviously work with clients who pay for my services, and mm-hmm. I wanted to offer something to the world that if someone heard it, they could feel less isolated, less alone, mm-hmm. And hopefully take a nugget or a tip or something to move forward in their own recovery. So the podcast is called the Embrace Family Recovery Podcast. And the whole concept is imagine sitting, having a cup of coffee, chatting with me about mm-hmm. their recovery story. And I really focus on family members' recovery stories because I don't think those are out there and as prevalent as people yeah. who are recovering from a substance use disorder or an addiction. And so it's been amazing to have different guests, different authors, different people who have had the courage to live their recovery out loud and share it, but also write their books and tell mm-hmm. their story, which just I'm in awe of people that do that because it is so vulnerable to put some of these stories out there.
It is.
And so that's why I did it, Jacob. I did it because I wanted people out there. You know, I think about what gives me the greatest joy about the podcast is I think about someone who's out there who's struggling like I was yep. when I first went through the relationship and I couldn't talk to anyone in my mind. I didn't know who would get it, who mm. would understand. And to think of putting an earbud in or a mm-hmm. headphone on and putting a podcast on and being able to go for a walk and be like, wow, that person's telling my story.
Yep.
There's hope. They found recovery. It wasn't easy, but this is yes. what they tried. Let me go and check out a meeting or let me grab that book they talked about yep. or, and maybe they can feel less alone and a little hope in a dark and difficult place. And so that's why I do it.
That is just so amazing. And do you do that like every week? Do you meet with someone or?
Yep. So I usually meet with people and do the interview and then I break it into three sections or two sections. Yes. So every week I have something drop when I'm not on a break. And I've had the privilege of meeting people from all walks of life and I hope it to grow. I have a feeling that where we may be heading is having some people on who are in yeah. recovery from substance use disorders and addictions mm-hmm. so that people can hear the hope in their story as well. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably where we're headed in the near future because I've been having a couple of people ask about that. So I think that's what I'm going to add to the podcast.
So where can my listeners find your podcast? Is it on sure. Apple or?
It is on Apple. It is on Spotify, all streaming platforms for the most part. Just look up Embrace Family Recovery. They can find it on my website. Also, all my episodes are there, which is the embracefamilyrecovery.com. That's my website. And if anybody is ever needing support from a family's perspective, that's my jam. That's my passion. I work with family members. One of my favorite memories in this time of coaching, which has been since February of 21, mm-hmm. was having one family on who had a sibling in treatment and there were seven screens and we were all yeah. meeting. It was so cool. Like to think of everybody showing up for their loved one yep. and each other like that.
I just want to thank Margaret for another awesome and amazing behavioral health integration episode. She was an amazing special guest. I also want to inform all of my listeners that the content expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. If you do find yourself struggling with any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed mental health professional or a licensed medical doctor. And if you want to find out more about my work, I do have a website. It's called behavioralhealthintegration.org. I am also on LinkedIn. My email is behavioralhealthintegration121@gmail.com. My Instagram page is BHI Podcast. My TikTok page is @JacobMBHI. And please follow my Facebook page, Behavior Health Integration. I also want to let everyone know that I have a new breathing device out there. It is called CalmeGo. It is a breathing device meant to detect and analyze your breathing, inhalation, expiration, and it really helps mitigate all types of anxiety-related issues to high blood pressure, increased heart rate, and as you inhale and then exhale, it really detects the depths of your breathing, so it can help teach you to give adequate breaths to, again, mitigate the anxiety-related symptoms. And if you go to callmego.com and type in BHI podcast on the promo line, you get $30 off. And this, again, is a once-in-a-lifetime deal. You will not be disappointed. So until next time, everyone have a good night. Bye.